Welcome to Paradigm Shifters, everyone. We have what is called an evergreen topic for you. Nina C. Payne has written an amazing book called Moments in Time, and it's going to take you and I through some the real depths of human relationships, life and death and jealousies and possessions. And oh my goodness, welcome to the show, Nina.
Thank you so much, Veronica. Thank you for having me.
Well, I had to get Kleenex when I was reading your book, my friend.
So did I.
Yeah, you know, when you write a book, and the book is supposedly it's fictional, but it's so alive that I feel like it must be a lot to do with your story as well. It intersects with your story quite a bit, does it?
Yes, actually it does. There's a lot of truth in the story, and there's the emotions in the story throughout the entire story are real.
Yeah, so I can feel them. Well, you know, I think that's really marvelous for people at home. This is a book that takes you through the death of your brother of cancer. And it's always, in the most poignant ways, it's the person that's the closest to you in your life in many ways, isn't it?
Yes, he and I, growing up together, it's interesting because my brother and I, Charlie, I had three brothers, and Charlie was the middle brother, and I was the youngest. We shared the same birthday 4 years apart.
Oh, you're kidding. Wow.
Yeah, it's kind of, and we were born the same hour, the 6 a.m. hour, so right around the same time. And for some reason, we just always shared this very, very special bond growing up with him. I not only felt that he loved me, but I felt he liked me, which is so important to a child to feel that they're liked and they're appreciated and their sense of humor is taken. And it just gives a child and boosts a child's self-esteem. And that's what he did for me growing up.
I love the way he taught you to ride your bike.
Yes, and that's true in the story. It's exactly the way that happened and the way I remember it. And I always remember, and still to this day, if I smell orange blossoms, I remember my brother. And the times we shared.
When did he pass? How many years has it been?
So he was diagnosed with terminal cancer in 2008 and was originally only given 6 to 9 months to live. At the most 12, they said. And so we were so blessed to have him for another 4 years, which was, he went way beyond the statistics, which is, you know, like I've always said, you know, I don't look at statistics because they can't measure the human spirit. Mm-hmm. And he exceeded their expectations and actually blew his medical team away. And we had time, and he passed in 2012. And then my father passed away, and me and my father were also very, very close 4 months after him. He just basically couldn't handle it. I always say he died of a broken heart, and quite literally he did, because his aorta ruptured.
Wow, that's sort of a double header for you, isn't it?
It really was, because I didn't have, once my brother passed, and I was taking care of my father, so there wasn't a whole lot of time to really process what happened with my brother. I did feel the incredible, incredible sadness. But then I was tending to my father, and then when he passed, it kind of all hit me.
Did your father, was your father able to talk about his feelings about his youngest son passing?
No. Okay. He really just, all he did was, for the last 4 months of his life, he sat in a chair, he refused to move, he barely ate, and the death impacted him in such a way that he couldn't go on. It just was so devastating for him to lose. And he was also particularly, the way I describe in the book, you know, Charlie was everyone's favorite. He was the favorite uncle, the favorite brother. He had such a pure and gentle soul, and anyone who met him got that right off the bat. So, yeah.
And how was your mom? She must have, I mean, that's a horrendous thing for a mother to lose a son and a husband all at once.
Terrible, terrible. My mother, fortunately, she stepped in. My brother had owned a restaurant, and she stepped in, and it was originally my parents, and started working, which has been a godsend for her, because it kept her involved with the community. My brother he's like a living legacy in Vista, California, where the restaurant was. They even named a day after him. August 22nd is Charlie Harb Day.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
He was so beloved in his community. So my mom is carrying on that legacy through the restaurant, and at the same time, it's helped her deal with the grief of losing both my father and my brother.
Just getting busy. You know, it's interesting when we talked about Andy, who's what he's called in the book, living 4 years longer than the prognosis. I find it remarkable reading your book about the interactive nature of your family. Your family is closer than a lot of families. I don't know if you're Italian or what, but anyway. don't you think that has a huge, huge impact on people, that they can last longer and they can be more healed as they go through these changes?
I really do. I really feel that, you know, we all supported him in different ways and in our own way. And it's like how I described in the book, our common denominator was Andy. You know, we may disagree on things, mm-hmm. but he was our common denominator, and we needed to focus on him and his needs. And, you know, really, when someone is in that situation, you can't try to say, well, this is what I need, so this is what they must need. No, you have to really empathize with what are their needs. How do they need me to be there for them? How do mm-hmm. I show up for them? Not how I think I may need it.
Yeah, you know, like I'm tired, I need a break. You know, we don't get that all the time, do we?
No, the caregivers are really overlooked. They think a lot, and they just deserve, for me, a standing ovation.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, that's a good thing to say. The other thing that goes on throughout the book is grief. And grief is, to me, a really poignant subject. It's a subject of what transformative influences in life and so on, isn't it? And it seemed like your family handled a lot of it quite consciously, would you say?
Mm-hmm. Really, I would say that, you know, we all handled it, of course, in our different ways. Mm-hmm. And we really had to, and one of the things that I always like to emphasize is that it is very true what people say. People handle grief differently. And the most important thing is not to judge how any one person is handling it. This whole process has really taught me in many ways and in many arenas, and like we were talking about layers of areas of my life, it's really taught me to become less judgmental of any situation, mm-hmm. because I don't know what's on the other side of a person and what their story is. And, you know, I dealt with it in a certain way, they dealt, but we supported each other. But the interesting thing about grief is it's a very solo process. It's like you're flying solo, even though you may be surrounded by friends and family who truly care about you and have your best interest. At the end of it, it's just you, and mm-hmm. we need to find for ourselves how we can best cope in healthy ways. Cassandra in the story had really been in the depths of despair and had maybe chosen a path that was balming her senses and soothing her senses in a way that maybe wasn't so healthy in some people's eyes. But it made her feel alive when she was feeling dead. So having been married for many years, and then she meets this other man who really sparks these intense feelings of desire and, you know, passion and all.
But you know
things.
What I like is the way you describe it is as if it's one of those meant to be, and they, you know, meet each other and it's like, whoa,
yep,
we have to do this. That's also something for people to think about. You know, it does happen, doesn't it?
It does happen, and that's one of the things that I've learned is that we can't judge another's story because we don't completely know it and we can't completely feel it. We can empathize, and that's all.
Do you think that this incredibly magical connection with your yoga teacher, I don't want to give the whole story away, you guys at home, but I think you'll love this story. But don't you think that really got you through a lot of this? It's some sort of transcendent spark or, you know, a different kind of a trance to get into periodically?
Well, I think what happened with, you know, there's Cassandra and there's Daniel, and they're the two, you know, they're having this forbidden, you know, love affair going on. And the interesting thing is that one of the things that Daniel says to Cassandra when they are having this really nice moment on the beach, but she's so conflicted about what's going on, is he says, look, she says, this is wrong, and she's really imploring with him, this is wrong, and he says to her, this is the way we feel isn't wrong. our circumstances may make it wrong, but the way we feel isn't wrong. And I think that was, you know, it's like I said, I mean, it's when you're feeling so low and you really are feeling almost numb, and then something comes along that just makes you feel alive. You just, who wouldn't?
You think it's a divine airlifting presence, don't you?
It feels like that. It really does. Mm-hmm. It really does. And almost a blessing in some ways, but then it can be a lesson. So,
Isn't everything a lesson? You're talking about not judging. I'm going, mm-hmm. Isn't everything kind of teaching us to stop judging, and you just don't know what's going on?
Yeah.
So, let me see. Let's talk about how it's almost like this, that the relationship that began to be sparked with you and with Cassandra and Daniel, it's easy to say it's you, right?
Yeah.
Kind of airlifted you out of a boring patch with your with her husband.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's very interesting. That often happens in people's lives. It's almost like it's really meant to be, huh?
Well, you know, I think what happens in relationships is, you know, when they start out, you know, of course, intensely passionate and this and that, you know, we can't stay in that state forever. Nobody would get anything done. You know, and there's a certain phase when you start having children, you get involved in the details of life and you tend to look past each other. You don't look at each other anymore the way you did initially. And you're just so involved and consumed with your day-to-day of trying to raise these beings that are so dependent on you.
Mm-hmm.
I think for many of us, we kind of lose ourselves. We start to just identify as a label,
mm-hmm.
and I'm a mother, and we're so much more than that. We're just these alive beings with all these feelings and emotions and mysteries that surround us and things that go on in our head that, you know, that we think about, but we don't always necessarily share. And it's very natural for that stuff. People, I mean, you hear it all the time. How many times have we heard people getting divorced, they grew apart?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's like your typical, you know, statement. We just grew apart. But then after that, that's when the real, after you're raising your kids and they get to a certain stage where they become more autonomous, I think that's where the real work of a relationship begins.
Mm-hmm.
And it can so easily be ran into the ditch, and a family unit can break apart because we long for that desire. We long for someone to see us and look deep into our eyes and really reach our soul.
Mm-hmm.
So we long for those soul connections.
But it is an interesting question. It's like, how many of us could ride through those, what would we call it, boring or plebeian or unawakened periods? Because, you know, when you said it's exciting when somebody can actually see us, I go, there's a part of me that goes, yeah, sometimes it's really hard for us to see ourselves. And sometimes through that reflection starts to awaken our own delving into more of who we really are. Don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't have said it any. I mean, that just, when you said that, I got the chills because it really is about looking inward. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we look outward for validation and for acceptance and for approval and for those feelings of fulfillment when it really starts within.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's also asking yourself the question, what can I give? You know, there's this saying, and I don't think it's cliche at all, and I think the grass is truly greener where you water it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not talking if you're in an abusive relationship, but if you're in a good relationship with someone who's been with you through years, it's like you have a city of memories with this person. It's worth not leaving any stone unturned and then reflecting inside of your own being and saying, what can I do? How can I give? How can I better serve
mm-hmm.
this person? And making it less about, I'm not getting this, I'm not getting that. And then starting to give those things that you feel you need to the other person. And then it becomes this perpetual cycle that just kind of feeds off of it. And it's amazing what can happen when you do that.
What is interesting to me that in the book, Cassandra's husband had some kind of spark going with his secretary or his assistant or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like getting that little... And I was thinking about several people that I've talked to relationship-wise recently, and sometimes that spark that comes from someone else's acknowledging of you is an ignition for a person to start to grow again, right?
Oh my gosh. You know, it's like this blossoming happens, this awakening happens, and you see the world differently through a different lens.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we can have, I don't think we only have one soulmate. We can have soulmates in many different forms. I look at my son as a soulmate.
Mm.
My daughter and I have this amazingly strong sisterhood. We have like this feminine connection that's very powerful and very strong. And I have, you know, people in my life who I consider them to be kindred spirits. You know, my circle is small, but it's powerful in what it does to nourish me. And when I was going through the year following the death of my brother and father, I got down to 89 pounds. I couldn't taste food. I didn't want food. I was so full of grief and despair. There was nothing anybody could say to me. You know, people would say, oh, you have kids. You have so much to live for. You have this. That was falling on deaf ears.
Mm-hmm.
Until I came to that realization, and until I came to the realization that time does nothing if you're not proactive, You just really have to come to that awareness. And I think awareness is key.
But how do you come to that, Nina? You know, it's easy for us, and I'm not putting you down, but I'm going, it's easy to say, grief is a, it takes you into a whole different way of being, and you're paying attention to different levels of life, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like not wanting to eat and all that, that's not really unusual for some people. And it's not just wake up, is it? It's like going through a huge change that is even biochemical, right?
Yeah, I think that it's, you know, embracing the pain, accepting the pain,
mm-hmm.
the hole that's in you and that consumes you, just kind of looking at it and going, oh, you're going to be with me for a while, so just be my companion through this darkness.
Mm.
It really is embracing it, but knowing that life is both. And if that type, this is where I came to kind of say what Oprah always said, my aha moment was when we had taken a trip to Boston. It was the exact week of my brother's death. And Boston, I'd never been there, but for some reason, we'd walk down these streets and I would see the brown. I was so just mesmerized by the city. I was fascinated by the people. I loved the brownstones. And I remember looking at this one brownstone, and this line of a poem that I had written many years back had said, "My dear friend, in the simplicity of life, all the opposites are equal." And that line kept going through my head. And then I thought, you know what? If the way I'm feeling this low, and I describe it in the book as feeling like you're belly flopping onto a bed of nails every 20 seconds, the opposite of that has equal or greater value. So what are the opposite of those feelings? Joy, love, an awakening, kindness, compassion. And I believed in that. And just having that faith and that hope that was around a corner for me. I don't know how long it was going to take together to get there, but having that hope and that faith and that belief that it was there started me, okay, let me get to class. Yes, let me start, you know, eating little food, chewing slowly. You know, let me start being more present with my children and smiling more and breathing more. I've been a yoga instructor and doing yoga for years. I lost my breath. And just doing the things I knew that would nurture me, getting myself out to the friends who loved me and the people who cared about me. And bit by bit, I started to come alive and I started to awaken and I became more aware. And man, I would have been happy to have been the way I was before my brother was diagnosed in that 4 years following. And I am I wrote a novel. I have a Facebook page with close to 17,000 followers.
Wow.
I mean, my whole life has just transformed. I'm a better mother. I'm a better wife. I'm a better friend. And it's just really transformed. And again, yeah, it is easy to say. People would say that to me, and I'd look at them like, you're out of your mind. This doesn't get better. It's like, yeah, it's easy for you to say. Try feeling what I'm feeling, you know.
Yeah.
But you know what? I can say it because I've gone through it, and you can say it because you've gone through it. And that gives us credibility.
Well,
and that's why we're able to help others.
And the way you look at, what did you say about judgment? And I'm going, you probably can hold the space for someone to be in kind of the grief insanity or whatever it is. You can hold the space for someone to go through that because it is a through, isn't it? It's not an end in itself. If you
Oh, no.
Let it be a through, right?
Yeah. Yes, and knowing it's going to rear its ugly head again, and that's some things that people don't want to accept. You don't just get through it. It's, you know, it's like I said, it's like the ocean. It's like it's this ebb and this flow. There's going to be times where it's going to hit you over the head like a 2x4, and you're just going to be in a state where you're feeling the sadness, but you just don't get afraid of it and don't panic. You know, just know it's going to pass, and then you'll feel these other feelings.
And there's a funny thing. You know, there's a movie about the tsunami, you know, the family. I don't know if you saw it. It's called, I can't remember, The Impossible or something. And mm-hmm. It intrigued me thinking about grief because in that movie, the family of five got split up and everybody thought everybody else was dead. But they reunited mm-hmm. at the end. And this is after 250,000 people had died, right? And,
oh, wow.
And they all, the three kids and the two parents, got together and nobody could believe it. Anyway, the mother had been very, very cautious and always kept her kids in a close rein and everything. And when they got back to wherever the country, I think Spain, and they recovered, that whole family began to do hugely brave things all over the world.
Yes.
Because I think it's the epitome of that grief, right? That you're never the same. I mean, it's a gift in the sense that it's a transformative process, right?
It's absolutely a gift. And just we went to Costa Rica. I'm terrified of heights, and I've never been quite an adrenaline junkie. I became an adrenaline junkie. I never knew I was. I was on these high suspension bridges. I was ATVing and couldn't go fast enough, river rafting.
Oh,
it is. It's like you lose your fear. I mean, within reason, I mean, you know, but, you know, it's just I take more risks now. I live a more fearless life.
Wow.
And I'm not, you know, with my children, it used to be before I was very structured and very disciplined and very concerned about ACTs and colleges. And the moment I let go of all that, my kids are thriving much more than they, when I was writing them about things, the moment I let go and let them be, that's not to say, I mean, I am still the mother and I am still, you know, there are boundaries and there's respect. But the moment I let go of expectations, our relationship began to flourish and they began to do their best work for themselves so that they can feel good and their self-esteem can feel good. No longer, it wasn't about me.
But it's interesting, it's kind of like you reevaluate. It's like there's a whole list of values and moving them to different levels that when you come out of it, don't you think?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Things just shift. Your whole, it's almost like this... You come more of a place of conscious awareness, and you become more aware when you're driving. Even, you know, you're looking around and you're in the present moment, and you're thinking in a more present, mindful state because you've experienced how quickly it can all be taken away. Mm-hmm. That we're not promised. That's why I called it moments in time. All we have is a moment in time.
Mm-hmm.
That's all we're given.
Mm-hmm.
There's no, you know, and I think a lot of the suffering is, you know, when we're clinging to something in the past and attaching to it so tightly or, you know, reaching too much in the future. So we're in a state of constant anxiety.
Or evaluating our success as this or that, as opposed to being, right?
Yep, absolutely.
Now, I want to, this is to, not shrink, but let's get into a narrower field right now, which is to go back into Andy's illness and mm-hmm. all the things that you had to do or that Cassandra did, and I assume that you did this, actually, to deal mm-hmm. with his cancer and all of that and how you handled it right up to the end when you had to give permission to take him off. Drugs and so on. Can you talk a bit about that whole process?
Absolutely.
Boy,
that was something. That was a difficult time. And in the story, basically, I made it where Andy had made that decision. In the true life scenario, I had to make that decision. Hmm. And I felt like I was making my brother's decision. I felt I was his voice at that point because he didn't have a voice anymore. The cancer had spread to his brain. I was literally doing things like I crossed so many boundaries I never thought I would. I was changing diapers. I was bathing him. I was doing all those things I never thought I would do for my brother. But he was no longer, I looked at him as I would look at a toddler, as my baby.
Mm.
So that's what kind of got me through that period where, okay, I gotta give him a shower. I gotta, you know, but I was also his medical director, director is what he comes with, but I had medical directive. So basically, I had to decide when to stop treatment, and I had to make that heart-wrenching decision. There was two routes we could have done. We could have done whole brain radiation, and it could have extended his life by a few months, and he would have been miserable. Mm-hmm. Or I could have stopped treatment. I chose the best thing was to stop treatment.
Did you choose it alone, or did anyone in the family choose with you?
We discussed it as a family, and the family was divided on that. And I ultimately just had to say, I know what Andy's wishes are. I'm Andy. I know what Charlie's wishes are. I spent so much time with him. I mean, I know what he wanted, and that's what I did. And I felt that I did and carried out his wish.
You had a very gentle comment in the voices of the characters saying there was dissension, that one of your sisters made an assumption that you were not caring when you made the decision, right?
And I was throwing in the towel.
Yeah, and I like the way you wrote it, because it wasn't attacking, but it is kind of what people would do. Like people jump at judgments from deep places of their own, don't they?
They do. It's a projection, and it's not, you know, it's really also the other key, I think, in life to happiness is not attaching personally to things people say, not taking things as, you're much happier as a human when you don't. I don't take things personally like I used to. I'm not, just not to say I'm superhuman and never do, but I what I try to do now is pause and reflect and realize it's really not about me. It's about them. When people lash out or they say something kind of hurtful or hateful, that's their reality and what they're experiencing. It has really nothing to do with mine.
And yet you're really sensitive, aren't you?
Oh boy, I have to be. I'm deeply passionate, deeply sensitive. That's where my writing comes from, and that's what's always saved me, I think, from even just as a child, from many dark places, is my writing. Yeah.
Well, this whole thing about cancer, I think, is a really interesting thing. Let's say a little bit more about that. Did you? How did you feel about all the chemicals and stuff? Did you want to argue? Did you have any sort of sense of alternatives or anything like that?
Absolutely. I mean, I knew that the stage of his cancer, where it was at, you know, I basically raised my children. You know, we've been really careful about what we consume and what we put into our bodies. And they're at the ages now where they can make their own decisions about that. I'm not going to, you know, shove anything down their throat or impose my values on them. But I've been on a plant-based diet since 1997.
Wow.
And
good
the
for
moment
you.
My bro- yeah, yeah. And the moment my brother was diagnosed, I had recommended to him. I said, I don't even mind cooking for you this way, but you need to eliminate all processed foods. And you just need to be on a plant-based diet, which is what he did. And along with the conventional medicine, because the cancer was so far along, you know, I felt like I was in a race against time. And I was reaching all, you know, researching a lot of alternative methods. But I do feel that the two combined at the state where he was in is what gave him that extra time. He couldn't have really done one without the other to have gotten him to the 4-year mark. Plus, he had an amazing team of doctors, which is so important. And it's so that there's a chapter in the book that talks about our search for a doctor. Mm-hmm. And we need to advocate for ourselves, because if you're in the wrong hands, things could go downhill very, very quickly. And there's a description of a doctor in the book who basically had given my brother a death sentence. And he couldn't, when I had attended, we'd gone to a doctor's appointment, it was the same type scenario. And I remember myself being very, very upset. And that I did take very personally, because I told him, there is no way you can tell me how long my brother has to live unless you're some kind of a psychic. Mm-hmm. There's no way. And we walked out of there.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting, because I love the way you wrote about it in the book as well. I love the way you had the courage and the vehemence to just say, sorry, we're not doing it that way, you know? And by the way, I am a psychic, Nina, and what I have
found,
and what I have found through the years is that we can actually renegotiate our death time. You know,
oh, I love that.
Yeah, and I've watched people over and over, and they'll say, well, when's so-and-so going to pass? Because a lot of people are already in the process of dying, you know. And that person will you've heard people say, I waited till so-and-so, she waited till so-and-so came for the wedding. She waited till she could see her son.
Right.
But it can be a lot more expanded. But I was touched by Andy's situation and the family around, because whatever modalities you choose, I think having that loving environment or support is very healing, don't you?
Very, very healing. And, you know, I think it keeps you looking forward. And I think it's important to look not where you're living in the future, but just looking forward to something. Like he had that race to look forward to and just, you know, being alive. You know, you can't, you know, you just can't look at numbers and statistics, because
no.
We're so much more than that.
We're so dynamic,
We are. And if he had listened to them, it's like you said, you can renegotiate. If he had listened to what they had told him and believed the statistics, he would have been dead within those 6 to 12 months.
So what
if he
you
did
tell
just
people,
as you said?
And what if
go
you
ahead.
Tell people at home, like, mm-hmm. how do they suss out who's a good oncologist? How do they, what do they trust? Because I know a lot of people will be in such a state of shock that they can't think straight, you know?
Well, the first thing is, I'd say it's important to research a doctor, mm-hmm. you know, and that's kind of one of my strengths. I'm really good at finding, you know, just doing my homework. It's very important to do your homework. And
do people
and
Yelp
also,
doctors?
Well, not even necessarily through Yelp, but through health grades, and you know, what are other patients saying, and then to even maybe see on different forums, go to different medical forums, you'd be surprised what comes up.
Okay.
You know, and it, you know, talking to the front staff.
Hmm.
You know, I remember this sounds very, very strange, but when I tore my ACL and I was scheduled for surgery the next day, I had on a limb just called the triage nurses there at the hospital where I was scheduled and found out the guy was practically a butcher who was about to work on my knee.
Oh, my God.
And then, yeah, and this was, you know, this was way back before you could even really research on computers that much. I've always been technologically challenged anyway, but you know, then I found this other doctor who's a great orthopedic surgeon. My knee is beyond repaired. I mean, he just did a miraculous job on my knee. But the point being is that we have to do our homework, we have to do our research, and then if you're in there and you are feeling less than or diminished or not supported and not respected and treated in a cookie cutter type way, run.
Good.
Don't have someone treat you in any situation like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a yoga class, wherever it is, in any way, in a relationship, if you feel diminished, unappreciated, disrespected, and you walk away from that relationship or that encounter feeling less than, run. It's
yeah,
not gonna
it's sort of
you.
Like your family situation in the book anyway. I'm assuming that's also your family. But surrounding him the way they did fueled his healing as well. And so
yeah.
With a doctor that you feel scared of, yeah, that's going to really make it harder, isn't it?
Yeah, and when the doctor doesn't put an expiration date on your loved one or on them, you know, I remember our doctor here who's with Moores UCSD Cancer Center, she had come up and gave him a gentle touch on the shoulder and said, we're going to do everything we can for you. And for a man like my brother, that meant more than anything she could have said or done.
Hmm.
Just that gentle touch, that connection, looking him in the eyes and saying, she says, I have a big arsenal. One thing doesn't work, we'll try something else. She says, you're young, because he was young when he was 48 when he was diagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, and it was the strangest thing she said. She says, other than the cancer, you're very healthy. So you have those things going. So she gave him hope. Not
wow.
False hope, true hope.
Yeah, by who he is sort of thing, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is so, so incredibly important. I'm trying to think of something else I was thinking of. Oh, I'm sorry. I've gone blank for a minute. I know what it was. When you, it was so dire and the family was so supportive, but you got into a situation which was right near the end of his life where you all got laughing. And I can really relate to that. It's like everything is just too much and something triggered your humor. Do you remember that? And you started laughing. I love that part because it is so true. I've heard people say, well, you know, so-and-so was laughing and that's terrible. And I got the giggles in that part of your book because it is so, I don't know what it is, but it's just like, it's so, well, talk about that if you can.
Well, you know, laughter is also an emotional release, not just crying. I mean, when we're laughing, I mean, what happened is it gets to the point of almost absurdity where you're just looking at things around you and you're not comprehending really what's happening. And then here's this person who really doesn't have much life experience trying to talk to you. And I do actually remember an encounter like that, but it's all becoming like a very much a veiled memoir, isn't it? And you know, you're in, how many times, who out there can say they haven't been in a situation where they're not supposed to laugh? Maybe in church, maybe at a memorial service, at a funeral, where they're not in a yoga class, they're not supposed to be laughing, but suddenly they do, and they can't stop, and it's uncontrollable.
Yeah,
there's nothing you can do to stop it, and it is, it's an emotional release. It's just you're releasing these pent-up emotions, but instead of crying or screaming, it comes out in the form of laughter. So, and it is the best medicine sometimes. You just got to laugh at it, you know.
And also, another thing is talk about the relationship, the potential of the relationship, the extramarital, absolutely magical relationship. How did that end? I want to talk about that a little bit.
I'm writing the sequel. I left the book like that intentionally.
Okay.
And so I'm working on my sequel. So it takes a direction, a very interesting direction that I think the readers will, I think some will be really surprised. But it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun to be working on that right now, and it's just an interesting development. Yeah.
I love that. And another thing is, after someone passes, and you've lost two people in short order, you know, quite often a family will disperse, or people just won't be able to get along anymore. Somebody said it's like somebody ripped all the strappings off the Velcro or something. I've talked to a number of families that just came apart. Has your family had to experience anything like that?
You know, it's interesting because we have my older brother and I are extremely close, and we've really, really bonded over what's happened. And it's interesting because I think you gravitate towards the family members who deal with things in kind of a similar way that you do. And me and my older brother really see this as a gift. We don't see ourselves as victims. We don't see ourselves as, you know, something happened to us that was so bad. We look at it as really, like you were saying, it is a gift in many ways what happened to us. Even though it was a death, we've learned so much, we've grown so much, we've evolved so much, and we're connecting with, you know, all of his kids are grown and graduates of college, but he just has this amazing connection with each and every one of them. He had it before, but now it's even on a more authentic level, and I think I've experienced that same thing with my kids. I can't wallow and be a victim,
no.
So I gravitated more towards him and his family, and then with my brother's family as well, because they tend to, they have the disposition of wanting to lean towards happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I gravitate towards. And I've learned that about myself. I remember, you know, this is interesting because I remembered when I was in really just a state of absolute grief. And I remember looking at these people that were laughing. And I'm thinking, they're laughing and life just goes on. And I'm sitting here, you know, longing for that.
Mm-hmm.
That's because that's the state that our body wants to be in. It always wants to get back to that equilibrium, that balance where we can laugh and we can experience joy, where we're not lopsided, really one way or the other. You can't stay in that euphoric state forever.
Mm-hmm.
But just to find that center space, that calm, that inner peace. And that's where our bodies and our minds and our emotions really long to be. Centered, balanced.
But I do think that there's something valuable about having gone into that really deep grief place and not being, let's put it in functional, not being normally functional for a while. I think that's also really, really important. And maybe it isn't happy, but there's a respect and an acceptance of a place like that that people go to in order to help them churn a new level of themselves, I would say. Also, the other thing I understood about grief is that it's very, very intense how much of your identity is linked to or is interwoven with the person who passes. I think that's what also makes it complicated.
It does make it complicated, and I think that's kind of depicted in the story where Cassandra gets up the next day and thinks, what do I do now? She's been a caregiver for her brother for so long. She wakes up that morning and she's like, who am I? I mean, she just couldn't even comprehend what her role was, who she was, and she really had to do a lot of soul searching to kind of come to that place of remembrance. And there was this little passage that I wrote one time that says, to hurt, and I'm reading it because I wrote it like at 3 o'clock in the morning and it's on my phone, but it says, to hurt from a place deep inside that is honest, quiet, and without desperation is one of the most serene, intensely beautiful places one can visit. Just be careful not to dwell there.
Oh,
that's
wonderful.
What I learned from my experience. Yeah, that's what I learned.
That's really something, isn't it? That's also something, when you said just be careful not to dwell there, some of that sort of feeling can be mesmerizing, so you can dwell there. Some people will be there for 20 years, right?
Yes, yes. And that's what I meant about in family relations, when something super tragic happens, you tend to gravitate towards the ones that are more towards your disposition of what you're trying to attain for your life.
Yeah, that's true. So what about your children? It was wonderful how your family, all the children were included in this dying process.
And yes, I was, yeah, go ahead.
Talk about that, because I think that I have a personal prejudice that that's the best thing to do for kids. So I just wondered if you had something to say about that.
You know, kids are so intuitive, and I think in some way we strip them of that. I have two creatives on my hands. And they're writers like their mom. They're very, very intuitive. So I have never been the kind of mother that gushes over a piece of art when I don't really care for it, or they'll show me a composition they've written and I think it's not from the heart. I've always been very honest with my kids. Mm-hmm. If they've brought me something and said, oh, I wrote this, I'll tell them, you know, honestly, this is not from the heart. Go back, write it, and when it can be authentic, bring it back to me. And as a result, when I tell them the truth about something, they believe me and they trust in my words. When I look at something and say, this is brilliant, this is great, their faces light up and they smile because they know mom's telling them the truth. Because I don't just feed their egos nonsense. It's just nonsense to do that. Yeah. It keeps them, you know, striving to go deep within and to create things from within themselves and from their heart. And so when it came to the cancer, you know, I was very honest with them. I was just like Cassandra was in the book. None of us know what's going to happen to us from one moment to the next. Your uncle is very, very sick. We don't know what's going to happen. And should he pass before, you know, how we honor the memory of those who passed before us is by living our best lives. That's how we honor their memory. And we will smile again, and we will be happy again through the sadness, not by ignoring it, not by suppressing it, through the sadness.
I think it's interesting because they experienced the death. It was right there. They were there, right?
They were there. Mm-hmm. They were asleep. There was a circle of us that gathered around my brother. It was basically my other brothers and myself, and that was it, basically. We made this semicircle around him. And here's an interesting perspective. So when my brother had taken his final breath, he just took this two inhalations in and then looked up, and then it was a short exhale out. And for me, I was out with my brothers in the driveway after this all had happened, and we were waiting for the people to come take my brother. And I said to them, wasn't that the most beautiful thing you've ever seen? And they both kind of looked at me like I was a little bit nuts at first. And I said, it was just like a bird who was trying to take its first breath.
Mm.
And then just kind of, he went so peacefully. And for me, I experienced it as a beautiful thing. And then my older brother, could really relate to that. Once he tapped into his own feelings, he says, yeah, I wasn't sure I should be feeling that way, but it was actually kind of peaceful and serene. Because he had had that death thing going on, that death
rattle, rattle.
That death rattle. Oh, man, that's nasty. Mm-hmm. So then when you see that just he's at peace now, and he's no longer that body. He's moved on. He's still everywhere, but he's moved on. And my other brother just thought he's haunted by that. And for me, no, I'm not.
So being haunted by that, has he gotten over it?
No.
Okay, yeah. But your children have experienced, you know, I think we live our lives, death is the biggest concern. Right? And so your children have been to the door with beloved beings, hey? And I think that's a really healthy thing.
Yeah, and knowing that it's inevitable.
Yeah.
And you get through it. And I think that's why we need to set that example for them. I mean, it's going to happen to all of us. And we just need to either face it with grace and with dignity and, you know, and respect of the process, or succumb to it and have it bring us to our knees. And it will do that for a time, definitely. And that's okay, too. We did cry as a family, and, you know, we did grieve as a family, but we got through it as a family.
Mm-hmm. And it didn't split you apart.
No, it could have very easily. And it almost did, mm-hmm. quite honestly. And
but your husband managed to be very supportive all the way through, didn't he? Yes.
Extremely. He's a rock.
Yeah,
he's absolutely, he's the most gracious, forgiving, compassionate man I have ever met.
Wow. So what would you recommend for people? How can people learn from this? I think there's a ton of learning in this book, even though it's, in quotes, a novel. Hello.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's so much about relationship, about loyalty, about truth with yourself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I love that.
Yeah, it's such a multi-layered story, and it really is about having more compassion for ourselves and for those around us, and really focusing on the things that are important and immediately, not, you know, there's this quote that the problem is, you know, you think you have time. We never know.
Mm-mm.
And it really is getting up every morning, and what I try to do before I even get out of bed is to take long, deep inhalations with a smile on my face. And I try to start every morning like that and every evening like that. And, you know, and just really pausing and reflecting about our actions and asking ourselves one simple question: is what I'm doing serving my greatest and highest good?
I like that a lot.
Move forward in that direction. And if it's not, then you need to look at it a little closer. And wondering why you're making certain choices.
When is your sequel coming out, or what is your? How do we track you down in a while, my dear?
Well, I have a website and I have a Facebook page, and it's Nina. My website is ninacpayne.com.
Okay.
I've always considered myself more a poet than a novelist, but I wrote a book, so that's pretty exciting. And there's information on there where people can get the book. It's on Amazon. It's called Moments in Time. And again, that's ninacpayne.com. And I also have a Facebook page, Nina C. Payne Author. And that's, like I said, I just started it in November, and I have 17,000 followers, which is really, really gratifying because people connect to the writings because it's, you know, it's about love, and it's about grief, and it's about loss and surrender. And I also have post some blogs on there, and on my website there's blogs and poems.
So it's about real life relationship stuff, right?
Yes. And I think that's why the following has happened so quickly, is because it comes from such an authentic, raw place, and I'm not afraid, and I used to be terrified to share my writing with anybody. I did it in private.
Mm-hmm.
But it comes from that, because I can't put anything out that's not raw and that's not authentic. Mm-hmm. And that's why I really, truly believe that when people read it, they feel it. Mm-hmm. They're like, I've been there. I have felt that. I have experienced that. Thank you for putting words to my emotions.
Mm-hmm. Well, I cried my heart out, so there.
So there.
What about your poems? Have you got some of those up on your blog or website? Or
those are on both. They're on my website and they're on my Facebook, Nina C. Payne Author, Facebook page. I have just a full page of my poetry, and I hope people will visit it because I think there's something there for everyone. There might be a poem that they don't relate to, but they can scroll through and see which one speaks to them.
Oh, and so you're still teaching yoga, huh?
Oh, yeah, but I do privates. I'm kind of paying it forward. I work with caregivers are my heart. I have so much love for the love that they give, and it's sometimes a very just overlooked and underappreciated. And also my goodness, the hospice workers. Wow. I mean, what angels are they? I mean, both experiences I had with two different hospices, one for my father and then one for my brother, then my father. I can't say enough about them. Mm. They're just courageous, wonderful beings on this planet. I think they're angels amongst us. I really do.
I think you're right. One of the things I wanted to ask you about those, going back mm-hmm. into the context of the book, when you talked about the spiritual counselor, mm-hmm. I thought, you know, that's a dicey role, isn't it? Because some of it I'm going, it's hard to find maybe the right kind of spiritual counseling. Or what do you think about that?
You know, I lean more towards what you do. I mean, I have two intuitives that, yeah, I think it's different for everyone, and I think that's, you're right, it is very dicey. Mm-hmm. And I think when you can, for me, the counseling that has helped me the most and still helps me the most is I have found intuitives, two of them, that are just remarkable and are the real deal. Mm-hmm. And so I think that you're right. The spiritual counseling, you know, our beliefs are so different and so vast, and it's such a personal thing that I feel that we have to reach out to what best serves us.
What best is a bit like looking for your doctor, isn't it?
Absolutely is. It certainly is. And, you know, that's what I gravitate towards personally. And that's what's helped me spiritually and really has given me some of the most tremendous insight I've ever had in situations in my life.
Oh, that's great. Well, of course, you've given us moments in time, and I want to think, well, yeah, it's like moments in time. Some of them are very rich, and the way you put it together in your book is wonderful. So this is Nina C. Payne, author. We're going to see you on Facebook and also in your website. And this is Veronica Entwistle saying to everyone, thank you for listening, and certainly this is a wonderful read, so... thank you. Good night.